A budget blueprint is through the Senate now that has a top line similar to the White House's plan for fiscal 2016, but the details between that plan and the plan the House passed look very different from President Obama's, including big cuts to some domestic programs. David Hawkins, a senior editor at Roll Call, and tracking the potential for which plans might be the ones you should pay attention to as to what will guide spending for your agency. David, and that's one issue, is what the two plans look like. I suppose another issue is exactly the timeline on which these will happen, because it appears with the recess that nothing at all is going to happen this week. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, as always, Francis. Even though the members aren't here for this week and next week because of the Easter Passover break, as we've discussed in the past, much of the real work gets done by the staff, and they are presumably putting together the outlines of the middle ground between what the House adopted last week and what the Senate adopted last week. In the end, they are much more similar than different. And when the members come back on April, I guess it's the 12th, they should be able to make pretty quick work of a conference agreement on the budget, which would be the first time that's happened since, 2009?
It's been a long time, yeah. And what I wonder, though, is how different that will be from anything that President Obama's indicated he's willing to sign.
Yes, well, that's the important question, right? So the budget is, the budget, we always remember, is a non-binding document with a couple of semi-exceptions, one of which is it is Congress's internal pledge for how much it wants to spend on discretionary programs in the coming year. And my back-of-the-envelope calculation is that probably where the House and Senate Republicans will end up is about $71 billion apart from Barack Obama and what Barack Obama thinks should be spent on all discretionary programs in the next year. And that's real money. That is more like, that's something like 7% or maybe even 8% apart. And that's a whole lot of money. So I think we can now see clearly towards a summer and then a fall where there's going to be yet another big budget standoff, but with a different dynamic than we've seen during this presidency.
And what does the different dynamic mean as far as people who are kind of shell-shocked from all the shutdown, countdown foolishness that we've been, having a little bit of fun with, but has been serious business for the last couple of years?
Well, the biggest difference is that this time, arguably, it's going to be the president who's got the shutdown clock on his desk, not the Republicans, because the Republicans are in a position anyway to move the 12 regular bills through the regular process and start churning them out and start moving them towards the president's desk, and then it will be up to the president to say, nope, I'm vetoing this thing because it doesn't spend enough money. And that's pretty much where he said what he said he's going to do. I mean, he's been pretty clear in saying we need to spend more on domestic and even some defense programs than the Republicans want to spend, and I'm going to veto bills unless they have the kind of spending levels in them that I think is appropriate. Now, the last time that happened, where there was this kind of dynamic, Republican Congress, Democratic president saying doesn't spend enough, doesn't meet with our values, was Bill Clinton at the end of his presidency, and Bill Clinton won those battles too. So just because it's different in this new time, it's going to be sort of the president's going to be the one saying we're keeping the government open or we're keeping it shut. As in the past, generally the president wins these battles for public perception.
It's no lock by any means that whoever in whosever's hands the shutdown is will be the one that suffers politically for it.
That's a much way of. Better way of making the point than I was. Yes, thank you.
David Hawkins is senior editor at Roll Call. The timeline here then appears to be the resolutions budget resolution will likely pass within a short period of time after they come back.
Yep.
Do we have a sense that the appropriators who will then go through and appropriate each of these 12 bills, has any of that started, and are any of the Republican leaders in either of the chambers working with Democratic members or staff to try to put bills together that can get votes?
Well, it's not. The process of is on track for doing the regular 12 bills, although the rules say that the subcommittees, the 12 subcommittees in the House and the 12 in the Senate, can't actually get started drafting bills until. Either until the budget resolution is finished or May 15th, whichever comes first. So they still got some time to wait. What they're really waiting for is after what the budget resolution does is it'll come up with two big numbers, one for defense programs and one for all non-defense programs. And then it is up to the appropriations committees to do what's called the 302B assignments. That's a little bit of jargon, but you'll hear it bandied around every year, which is essentially the chairman and their top so-called cardinals, the chairman of the subcommittees, essentially hash out how to carve up those two pies, the one for defense and the one for all non-defense, and how much to allow each of those subcommittees to spend. And that process should happen by early May, and then the subcommittees are ready to go.
And this all sounds like it's proceeding apace. This all sounds like, unless something crazy happens that sends it off the rails, like we're looking at bills maybe teed up as soon as Congress comes back from the August recess, or maybe before.
Oh, I think if we're on track, that this means that the House subcommittees will start producing. There's a dozen of them. You could see 3, 4, 5 of them go in the first week. Generally, they stagger them. Sort of the easiest, the most politically easy bills go first, and it's subcommittee 1 week, full committee the next week, House floor the third week. So, if he hasn't promised to do so already, I'll bet that Hal Rogers of Kentucky, the Republican who's now in his final 2-year term as chairman of House Appropriations, will say he has every intention of getting all 12 bills passed through the House by July 4th, and he should have no problem doing that. Unless some of his own Republicans start getting squeamish about that they're not spending enough money and that they're wasting time because the president's only going to veto them.
The last thing that we do here normally is politics stuff, David, as you well know, but it would be inappropriate, I think, to ignore the departure, the imminent departure, at least, of the Senate Minority Leader and former Majority Leader Harry Reid. I am struck by the very flowery descriptions of his tenure as Senate Majority Leader, and I don't mean to minimize that in any sense of the word, but I couldn't help but think over the weekend as I was reading some of the background stories on his decision not to seek re-election as senator from Nevada next year and thereby leave the Senate. It occurred to me that, you know, there have been other Senate majority leaders before Harry Reid before, but some of the coverage that I saw over the weekend, not in your publication, but other places, seemed to indicate that some of the folks writing about it thought there never was one before.
Well, he certainly has been doing it a long time, and by the time he's over, he will have been doing it for 10 years, and that's the second longest tenure for a Democrat ever. So it has been a long time. I think. What is true is that if you're dispassionate and if you're a reporter like I am or some of the other people who cover this thing and you really don't have a rooting interest in one party winning or the other, but you do kind of have a rooting interest in non-traditional characters having some success. And I would say Harry Reid is the antithesis of the modern American politician, you know, kind of a rhetorical, little bit troubled rhetorically, not a smooth guy. Prone to gaffes or sometimes purposeful gaffes.
Not flashy.
kind of a grumbler. But as I say, in a taste, kind of an endearing acquired taste for those of us in the press corps, I'll admit to it.
Senator Reid will depart. We know already that Senator Schumer did a fairly good job of consolidating support.
He did.
Sufficient. I mean, he didn't waste any time. He went right to Durbin and went right to Senator Murray, the people that talked about potentially on Friday as other challengers to Senator Schumer, and got them to support him.
That's right. Murray just today, and I'll boast that we actually broke that story, that Murray endorsed Schumer just this morning. I believe we had that story first, but so now the race is essentially over. It is Schumer's. Schumer is the heir apparent or the heir presumptive.
What does a Senate caucus look like? A Democratic caucus led by Senator Chuck Schumer of New York.
You know, I think ultimately it'll be different stylistically, because Chuck Schumer is all about his rhetorically. I mean, the guy is a great messenger for the party. He had been a great political tactician for the party. One of the reasons he was able to wrap this up so quickly was he ran the Democratic campaign operation that elected most of these Democrats. And his mantra is all about them. He has sort of a Clintonian-like mantra about the party of the middle class. So I think you'll see that kind of better message discipline, maybe more friendly message discipline than what we were just talking about with Harry Reid. Ideologically, probably not much different.
One of the things that Senator Reid was very willing to do, though, was beat Mitch McConnell or the Republican leader, whoever he was, over the head in public and negotiate with him directly and usually pretty effectively and cooperatively in private. Do we have any sense that Senator Schumer's willing to work that way? I mean, he's very close to Senator Reid, and so no doubt he's been watching him operate from up close the last couple of years.
I would say that Schumer has, I mean, Schumer's, the character of Chuck Schumer is that he's sort of, you know, the oldest joke on Capitol Hill is the most dangerous place to stand is between Chuck Schumer and a microphone.
It's a great joke,
too. And I think that's true up to a point. I think Chuck Schumer over the years has become, very plugged into leadership skills, is seen as an honest broker, is seen as somebody who will deal in the customary, manner that you need to deal. In order for the Senate to function, the two top leaders need to trust each other. And I think that Schumer will engender that kind of trust and will trust McConnell, and at least the place, I think, parliamentarily will be a functioning place.
David Hawkins, senior editor at Roll Call. Is there anybody on the Hill this week? I mean, is everybody on spring break since the members are out?
The place is pretty darn empty.